B'vakasha, Rabbi Weider, let's get started. There's a lot to do, so we want to give you as much time as possible.
Okay, so this is where there are sort of two parts to the material that you have in front of you. I think the source sheet got duplicated there, but I'm going to share my screen in just a little bit. The first part I want to go through the ta'amim, comment about each of them, each of their levels. I don't know which source sheet you have seen so far, but I'm going to share with you this one. Oh, let's see. Is it that people can see it now?
Okay. Yes.
So, yes. So I want to go through each of the trup. Those of you who are Balei Kriya or even semi-Balei Kriya will be relatively familiar with this. And then I want, as we go through these sequences, go through each trup and make some comments about it. The more you're familiar with trup already, the more some of this will resonate. Generally speaking, trup comes in certain kinds of patterns, expected patterns. And some of you, again, many of you who might be Balei Kriya or very familiar with the ta'amim will know that certain trup, when you see one trup, you're always going to get another trup with it. And there are some very definite patterns. But let me start at the beginning. What I printed for you here, what I'm sharing with you, is relatively close to what you'll see printed in the standard Ashkenazi tikkunim. I've made a couple of changes, but this is basically what you're going to see. So we start out on the first line, the first two trup. Oh, so before, let me talk about one thing before that. Trup come in two flavors. I'm going to stop my share just for a moment. Trup come in two flavors, mafsikim and misharsim. A mafsik indicates that once you finish the word that the trup is on, there's some type of a pause. There are at least four different levels of mafsikim. But they all have the characteristic of being some type of a pause, at least in terms of the sentence structure, not always in meaning, as I'll talk about a bit later. Everything else are what we call misharsim. They serve the next word. They're in effect attached to the next word. One of the rules of grammar, not related to trup per se, but is very much dependent upon this. If you ever wonder, it's the perhaps I would say the nightmare Balei Kriya, how to know when a word begins with a bays versus a vase, or a tough, if you're Ashkenaz, it's the tough versus a suf, or a pay versus a fey, and a cuff versus a huff. And we're not talking about Yemenites here, but gimels and dalas as well. How do you know when that first letter gets a dagesh or not? And there's actually a very simple rule, which in this business, there are always exceptions because there are always different kinds of things. But the basic rule is as follows. In order for a word to drop the, what they call the beged kefet dagesh at the beginning of the word, in order to drop it, two conditions have to be met. Number one, the previous word has to end on a vowel, not on a consonant, what we would call an open syllable, not a closed syllable. The way we're taught a rule, it's a rule of thumb, but there are a lot of exceptions in both directions, is that if the previous word ends on aleph, hey, vav, or yud, most of the time that means it's ending on a vowel. There are many exceptions to the rule, where simply the fact that a word ends on an aleph, hey, vav, or yud doesn't mean that it's ending on a vowel. For example, the word a love ends on a vav, but that vav is a consonant, not a vowel marker. Or a word like a lie, that sound at the end is a diphthong, there's a y there, there's actually a consonantal yud, and therefore it's not ending on a vowel. I, oi, and oi. Only e and a are ending on vowels. So again, this is a basic rule of thumb, aleph, hey, vav, and yud, but it really is if it ends on a vowel. So if the previous word, number one, ends on a vowel, and number two, if the previous word is a mishares trup, which means it's attached to this word, then the beged kefes dagesh will generally drop. And in fact, what I will tell you is if you see these two conditions met, and yet you see a dagesh in that letter, it's not a dagesh kal, for those of you familiar in grammar, it's actually a dagesh chazak, it's a different kind of dagesh. Rabbi Kelman, some echo. Okay. So that's a tip off, but as a general rule, if you see the beged kefes dagesh drop, you know the previous trup is a misharis. But you don't need to use that as the rule. You can have a list, which I do provide at a certain point. You'll have a list of all the levels of trup. It's the last thing on the source sheet that I just shared with you. It's a 2-page document. You haven't seen it yet. But that's the primary distinction that we have between trup. I am going to really be interested primarily in the Mafsikim. We need to know what a Misharis is, but there are different kinds of Misharsim. A Misharsim often serve, a Mafsik often has a certain type of Misharis, a certain type of servant. Some Mafsikim have multiple kinds of Misharsim. But I'm not really interested in the different kinds of Misharsim. I'm going to run through them here, but that's not what we're going to focus on. We're really interested in getting to the pauses, to understand how the pauses break up a particular verse. There is a two other little markers, that symbols that you should be aware of that I'm not going to deal with at all. One is called the Ga'aya, which is it looks like a siluk, a sof pasuk. It's a little line, but it's actually most cases a secondary accent marker. I'm not going to talk about that. And then there's something called the makaf, which is that dash that will join two words. For our purposes, when you have the makaf, not going to talk about the rules when you get it versus when the words each have their own trap. But a makaf basically makes two words, or sometimes more than two words, even up to four words, it will make them into effectively, for our purposes, a single word. So I'm not going to deal with those, but in theory, those are also in the category of trop. Now, mafsikim, before I start to go through the individual trop, there are four different levels of mafsikim simply by categorization. We have what's called the kesarim, the Caesars, that's the highest level ones. Below them, we have malachim, our kings. Malachim have Mishnim, a Mishnah Lamelech. They have one level of Mafsik below that. And finally, we have Shalishim. Those are the four levels of division of the various kinds of Mafsikim. The Shlish is a particularly complicated one because there might be multiple levels of Shlish. In the instance where these are not enough to break up a verse into its various units, we keep using shlishim. I'm not actually going to go through any examples. It's not going to talk about it. But sometimes a shalish is not going to follow all the rules we have because we have primary shalishim and secondary shalishim. But for our purposes, to understand the basics of the system, it's enough to stick with these four levels. And in the examples, at least that I've selected, if we get to them tonight, are examples where you don't need to break down more than four levels. But there are sometimes very long psukim that actually may require more than four levels of breaking, and that's when it gets a little bit more complicated. So now, looking at the trop list, I'm going to share again. And the first two trop here, the Kadma and the Munach, are very common Misharsim. They serve the words that follow them. You can have more than one Misharis in a row. Notice the first Misharis is serving the next Misharis, which is serving the Mafsik that comes after. The first Mafsik that we encounter is a Zarka. A zarka, the way we see it right now, some might describe this as a snake. I think there's a Zohar in Parshas Pinchas that describes this as a snake. This was not always the shape of the zarka. Once upon a time, it looked more like a candy cane, exactly a candy cane, like a kind of a hook and a longer thing like that. But not the shape of the trop, some of it has changed over time, and and printers also have changed certain things. Now, the zarka is a Mishneh Lamelech. And a Zarka, with one exception in Tanakh, is always going to be followed by a Segol, which is a Melech. You can have a Munach in between. Occasionally, rare occasions, you have two Munachs in between. But a Zarka, the Mafsik that's going to follow a Zarka, is always going to be a Segol. There's one Pasuk in Yeshaya Mem Vav. I think it's maybe the opening Pasuk, where you get two Zarkas, and there's no segel that follows. And then next goes to like Munach Rebi'i. It's the only place in Tanakh. But as a general rule, a zarka, you might have two zarkas and then a segel, but it's going to end, whenever you have a zarka, with that one exception, it's always going to end in the sense of a segel. Now, if we move on, now the zarka, and I don't know why, but the zarka is always written really on the last letter or after the last letter of the word. That doesn't tell you where the accent is. In order to figure out the accent, when you have a word with a zarka, you have to know biblical Hebrew. You have to know where the accent belongs in that word. One of the ways of doing it, if the word is found, if it's a common word, is just look to another place where that word has a regular trop in it. When I say regular, I mean most trop, the trop is placed over the letter where the accent is, over the syllable where the accent is. So if you find a word which has a zarka, but you're not sure where the accent really is, go look to where that word occurs with a regular trop, and then you will know where the accent is. Now, following the zarka, you'll get a munach segol, sometimes immediately to a segol, occasionally, rarely, two munachs and a segol. And a segol is the first melech that we encounter. Segol is actually very interesting trup. Firstly, you can imagine why it has the name that it has. It has that name because it has a segel. It's the three dots. Okay, it's a little bit upside down from the way we write a segel. The segel, this is what's interesting about a segel is that sometimes, I said last week, and I'll probably mention this a few times, the trup on the 21 Sfarim, not counting the Sifrei Emes, the Mishlei Iyov Tilim trup, only naturally lends itself to dividing things into two, including the whole pasuk. However, if you actually pay attention, the segol often provides sort of a third stop. For I don't expect anybody here to know Tehillim Trop, but if you know what an Olev Yored is in Tehillim Trop, I believe that a segol often fills that function, where it really helps divide the pasuk into three parts, the segol, the esnachta, and then the self pasuk. But either way, the segol is always going to be at the beginning of the pasuk. It's always, when you have a segol, it always has to be the first melech in the pasuk if you're going to have one. And a segol can only appear before the esnachta. If not all pasukim have an esnachta, but almost every pasuk that happens to have a segol will have an esnachta. And in such a case, you will never find anywhere in the Chaf Aleph Sfarim that a segol follows an esnachta. There may be a very rare occasions where there's no esnachta and you have a segol. I think Reb Breuer counts them, but that's very unusual. It's very unusual because you generally only get a segol when you have a fairly long, a relatively long verse. Once you have a relatively long verse, you almost automatically have an esnachta. But okay, but the segol is the first melech, and if you have a sequence of melachim before an esnachta, segol is going to be the first one. And to the best of my knowledge, I'm not aware of any pasuk with two segols in it, two zarka segols. Maybe I'm missing something, but I don't think there is such a thing. One interesting thing, and I might have misstated this last week, I'm not sure, is that a segol has a substitute trup. A substitute trup, which is a shalsheles. A shalsheles is defined as a thing with a chain followed by the line afterwards. There are only, I think, seven shalsheleses in Tanakh. A shalsheles, I know there's a tradition, it's probably not correct. I can't find its origin, that a shalsheles expresses doubt, uncertainty, hesitation. I can't find this in any traditional sources. The only thing that I found is quite to the contrary. Rabbeinu Bechaya, in his commentary on Parshas Vayeshev, on Vayimain, on Yosef, says that Yosef was firm in his refusal. There were no doubts whatsoever. So again, you don't have to agree with Rabbeinu Bechaya, but I don't know where this idea that a shalsheles implies, you know, uncertainty or hesitation. I think I know where somebody came up with the idea, because one of the four shalsheles in the Torah is vayism hama, which means exactly that, like Lot couldn't make a decision, but I don't think the other shalsheles have anything to do with uncertainty or doubt or hesitation. A shalsheles is simply a substitute for a segel when you only have one word. There's no room to make zark or segel, so instead you get a shalsheles. Okay, so that's the first melech. Then the next thing we get is a munach revi'i. Now, those who are Balei Kriya know that the way we lane this typically is munach revi'i. Now, unfortunately here, this is not well understood. The first munach is not a munach, actually, it's not a regular munach. It's called a munach legarmei. The Aramaic term legarmei means la'atzmo. A regular munach is a misharis. It serves the next word. A munach legarmei, which is written as the munach symbol, that, I guess, reverse L, followed by a pasek afterwards, that is the trop. And a munach legarmei is a third level pours. It's a shalish. I guess that's really fourth level, the way we count things. A munach legarmei is almost always found before a rivi'i. The normal sequence is what you see here. Munach legarmei, munach rivi'i. Now, there are two situations where it doesn't look like this, and many people don't realize that it's still a munach legarmei. The first one, which I have seen, I also used to do wrong, is when you have a munach legarmei, a munach with a pasek, followed immediately by a revi'i. For example, in the Nesi'im, shineihem mileim. So Reb Breuer points out that with almost no exceptions, that may have started out actually as a munach followed by a pasek, an interruption. But once it was put together, the Balei Masora treat that as a munach legarmei. So if you're reading, you would read shineihem mileim, and all of those should be done like that. there are some very rare instances where a munach legarmei is not followed by a revi'i at all. Now, normally, when you see a sequence of like munachs and you see a pasek, you just assume that each is a munach followed by a pause. They wanted to break it up, which is what is usually the case. There are very rare cases. I know of one, there might be two, but I know of one in Chumash where, and in fact, I didn't realize this, and a student I was teaching bar mitzvah did it wrong, and it turned out he was right. It's at the end of Parshas Toldos, Vayelach Esav el Yishmael. The next thing is Vayikahaha Esmochalas bas Yishmael. That is not a munach plus a pasek. It's a munach legarmei. There is something of a rule there. They're so rare that I wouldn't worry too much about that. But anyway, so that is a munach legarmei. And again, it will almost always only be before a revi. Now here we come to, I want to say my favorite, a revi. A revi is a mishnah. But here's the very interesting thing. What does a mishnah normally serve? A mishnah serves a melech. However, what you can have in sequence, and I'll have to explain how this works, is you can have multiple mishnahs preceding a melech. Now, one of them is the primary, is the first one, and the others break things down further. It happens to be a revi'i is never what we call a mishnah acharon. A revi'i will never be the last mishnah before a melech. We haven't seen all the malachim, but I'll just tell you what they are now. The three malachim are the segol, the zakeif in all its flavors, and a tipcha. Those are the three malachim. And you will never get, as the mishnah, to any of those malachim, you'll never get a revi. There's always a different, each one has its own mishnah. We might call it a mishnah acharon. But a revi is never a mishnah acharon. It always comes earlier. Now, I'm going to say something a little radical here, which I'm not going to attempt to prove. And maybe I'm wrong, but I'm pretty convinced that a revi sometimes serves as a super melech. I don't know why. If you look at a lot of psukim, I think it's very clear. A revi will often come early in the pasuk, and it's clear a colon belongs after it. It's strong an interruption. You know, as I said, it's a super melech. It's almost a kesar. I don't know why Reb Breuer in his treatment, he doesn't treat it that way. I mean, I understand why. People try to follow rules. But I think if you look at meaning, there sometimes a revi is just a revi, and sometimes a revi seems to be a very, very large pause within a pasuk. But the standard assumption of the revi is that it's a mishnah lemelech. Following that, we get to the next sequence, which is mapach pashta, followed by usually zakev katon or munach zakev katon. Now, a mapach is a mishares. It is always, as far as I know, I'm going to state something now. Almost every rule has occasional exceptions. And if I may tell you that I'm pretty sure there are no exceptions, and somebody's going to dig out some pasuk somewhere in a good printing that will be an exception. But to the best of my knowledge, and I'm almost certain for the Torah, there is no mapach that is not followed by a pashta. The mapach serves the pashta. The pashta happens to be a mishneh, and the mapach happens to be a misharis. Every mapach is going to be followed by a pashta. Now, there is one other trop that looks like a mapach. I'm going to scroll down for a second here. And that is the yisiv. Someone actually asked me a question about the placement of the trup of the yisiv. Now, let me just make this a little bigger because it's, unfortunately, the yisiv right here is touching up against the shva. The mark is touching against the shva. Now, the yisiv happens to be a substitute for a pashta. When you have a pashta, I don't know if we mentioned this last week, when you have a pashta whose accent is on the first syllable of the word, it turns, and it's not preceded by a mapach, it will turn into a yisiv. Now, the reason why they place the mark for the yisiv before the first letter is because you would otherwise confuse it with a mapach, because a mapach is placed where the accent belongs. And if you did the same thing for the yisiv, sometimes we have a sequence, for example, in the Akedah, that one has a mapach afterwards, but you have sequences where you have a pashta, a yisiv and a pashta, and you wouldn't know whether you're looking at a yisiv and a pashta or a mapach and a pashta, because both of them are logical sequences. So the way they distinguish is by placing it before the word. There are printings. I don't have a Korain in front of me. I believe Korain decided to go one step further, and they turned the yeshiva into a wedge of pizza. I think that's what they did. In other words, they put a little, the yeshiva is this wedge, and they put a little curve to close it off like a slice of pizza. That is not how the yeshiva was originally written. If you look in the Masoretic manuscripts, the Masoretic codices, you will see the yeshiva is just like a mapach, but it is pulled before the first letter of the word. So that's the mapach versus the yeshiv. The yeshiv, like the pashto, which it substitutes for, which is our next trap, is actually a Mishnah lemelech. Now, pashto is what's called the Mishnah acharon for the zakef katon. In other words, I don't know that there are any exceptions to this in a larger picture. Every pashto, whenever you have a zakef katon, and there's a Mishneh, a Zakef Katon is a Melech. The Mishneh LaMelech is always going to be a Pashta, the closest one. There are very rare exceptions. Almost always, the Pashta is immediately followed by a Zakef Katon or by Munach Zakef Katon or occasionally Munach Zakef Katon. There are very rare instances, at least in the Torah. I know of one or two. One of them is in Parshas Tetzaveh in Perek Haftes, where you get mapach pashta, and then you don't get a zakef katon immediately. You have intervening trap, but then still, all of that trap in between are not mishnes. They're all shalishim or less. And the next time you get to a melech, you will find the zakef. But those instances are very rare. Almost every pashta is going to be followed within one, two, or three words by a zakef katon. Which then brings that under the pashta. I have to comment about the placement of the trap itself. The Pashta trop is placed after the last letter. And the reason for this, Bali Kri, I think, now is fairly obvious, is because this bedeviling trop here, Kadma. A Kadma is the exact same symbol as the Pashta. A Kadma is a Mesharis. It's attached to the next word. The only way to distinguish that from the Pashta is to put the Pashta after the last letter. Here, however, because the Pashta is probably the most common trop that doesn't have the symbol placed above the accent, it's for that reason, this is the one case that the Balei Masorah themselves already invented a nomenclature, that if you want to know where the accent on the Pashta is, you look at it. If there's one Pashta on the word, then it's going to be written after the last letter, the accent is Milera. It's on the last syllable. Whenever a pashta is on a word where the accent is mil-el on the second of the last syllable, you will get two pashtas, one after the word and one where the accent actually belongs. But as soon as you see two pashtas, two of the symbol of pashta, you know it's a pashta, not a kadma. If you see only one, if it is after the word, then it's a pashta. If it is not, then it's a kadma. There are occasions where it's very hard to tell whether it's a kadma or a pashta, because the accent happens to be on the last letter. And you have to look very carefully to decide, is that in the middle of the letter or is that at the after the letter? The example that comes to mind is lo yikshev einecha bishalechacha osochav sheimimach. The sequence actually is kadma mapach pashta bishalechacha osochav she. But bishalechacha, the last letter is a chaf, that's where the accent is, and you have to look very carefully to figure out that it's a kadma. The meaning, incidentally, makes sense that it's a kadma, that it's attached to the next word, but you have to do a double take there. Most of the time, it's pretty clear, because most of the time, even when the accent is on the last syllable of a word, it's not on the last letter. Okay. So that's the pashta and how you distinguish it from a kadma. And again, a pashta is a mishnah, and it's a mishnah achron. It's the last mishnah before a zakef katon. A zakef katon is a melech, whereas the segol that we mentioned earlier is always the first in a sequence in a pasuk, a zakef can be first, but it can't be last. The distinction of being the last melech before the kesar belongs to the last melech, which we haven't gotten to, which is the tipcha. But the zakef katon can be either the first or in the middle when you have a sequence of melachim that precede either an esnacht or so pasuk, which are the kesarim. A zakef katon and a zakef gadol are the same level of pause, but a zakef gadol is really dictated by when it's on a single word. It has to do with number of words slash number of syllables. So when it's a very short thing, you just get a zakef gadol. Otherwise, it's going to be a zakef katon. It will have any number of syllables or words that might precede it. Okay, the mercha, we haven't mentioned the mercha is a mishares, a very common mishares. And that brings us to the tipcha. The tipcha is the melech acharon. It is always the last melech in a sequence before either an esnacht or a sof pasuk. And this actually makes things a little bit complicated. Let me put it this way. Every pasuk or every esnachta and every sof pasuk, unless the half pasuk that it concludes is one word, I'll give you examples in a second. Unless it's only one word, there's going to be a mercha there. For example, in Parshas Vayigash no Miketz, when they're chasing the brothers, it says Vayasi game, Vayidaber alayhem kadvarim ha'ele. Vayasi game is the first word of the pasuk. It's got an esnachta because it's a single word or a single unit. There's no tipcha. But if there were another word there with a trap, it would have to be a tipcha. Same thing holds on the sof pasuk. Next week's parsha, not this week, but Bishalach, we're going to have in Rishon, you're going to have Ayasu Chaim, which is the part after the Asnachta. It's literally, it's one word. It's attached with the Makaf. That's one word, and that has a sof pasuk on it. There's no tipcha there because there's no other trap. But if you had anything else, there would always be a tipcha. What this means, though, is that tipcha can be different kinds of levels of pause. Sometimes a tipcha is not a pause at all. If the pasuk is literally only two words, the tipcha may not be a pause. It may be there because that's the only way that the music or the setup allows, not because it actually is a pause. Most of the time, the tipcha is some level of pause, but it technically a melach. We will talk more about that. Then we get to the esnacht. I think this is probably the most, this and the sof pasuk are the most familiar trap to people because most people are taught at the very least to divide the pasuk into find the esnachta. Okay, next we get to the pazer. The pazer is considered a shalish. And the truth is, in the sequence we're going to get to it on the next line. Normally, the last shalish before a mishnah, the last shalish is normally a gerish or a gershayim on the next line. And what is supposed to precede the gerish or gershayim are all supposed to be pazers. It should be one, if you need multiple shalishim, they should all be pazers. The problem is that a pazer needs a certain amount of space, a certain number of syllables. And if you don't get that, what often happens to certain pazers is they turn into a tlisha gedola, which also happens to be a shalish. But a pazer normally is going to precede a gerish or a gershayim. When I say gerish, some of you will call that the asla or the asla gerish. Now, a pazer has a substitute. The pazer substitute is a pazer gadol. A pazer gadol is known to most of us by the term karne fara. When in my early years of laning, I had no tradition on a karne fara, so I used to read a karne fara as two tlishas, because that's what the symbol was. But when a distinguished mentor of mine pointed out that it's labeled, the real label is Pazer Gadol, I decided, and it was not my decision, I'm probably not the first one to figure this out, that we have three musical notes here. We have a Pazer, a Pazer Gadol, and a Shalshalas. And we all know a Pazer is one, and a Shalshalas is three Pazers. And therefore, by process of elimination, the way I do a Karne Fara slash Pazer Gadol is actually doing a double Pazer. Fortunately, this doesn't come up very often. It only comes up once in the Torah, Kriyas HaTorah, and once in Mikra Megillah, and that's it. At least of the things that we read liturgically in Shul. So they're very rare. There are 16 Pazer Gadol slash Karne Faras. And in case you were wondering, the other very bizarre trap, the Yerach Ben Yomo, don't ask me how to read that one. The best suggestion I've heard was to stand on your head and read an Esnachta. But the Yerach Ben Yomo, also known as a Galgal, is always a Mishares to a Karne Fara. There are 16 Karne Faras. There are 16 Yerach Ben Yomos. I haven't looked at everyone with my own eyes, but I'm pretty sure everyone, they're all together. You see a Pazer Gadol, you're going to get a Yerach Ben Yomo right before it. Okay, so that was the Pazer. Tlisha Ketana is just a Mishares. We spoke about the Tlishas last week. The reason why the Tlishas, Tlisha Ketana again is always after the word. Tlisha Gadol is always before the word. When you have words that are joined together, the nomenclature is to put it right before the first letter of the last word, right? Tlisha Gadola is joined by Makaf to make it one word. And that's where you can see where they put the Tlisha Gadola. Most of the time, it's a single word. The Tlisha Gadola will appear before the word. Now, how do you know where the accent is? So once again, you have to look elsewhere in biblical Hebrew. Here's the problem. The problem is, sometimes there are kind classes of words that are exceptional. One word that causes a lot of consternation for Balei Kriya, and once created quite a kerfuffle in my shul, is the word shatu in Parshas Pahalosha. The pasuk is shatu ha'am v'loketu. Now the word shatu is a klisha katana, so the accent is placed at the end. By logic, it should have been shatu on the shin because it's an ayin vav verb. It's a hollow verb, the middle letters of vav. That would be the norm. But there are many exceptions where you have ayin vav verbs where the accent happens to be on the last syllable. Last week's parsha we read, visaru hatzvardeim. It should have been visaru, but it's not. And there are at least a handful, literally, if not more, in Chumash alone, of these exceptions. The Mincha Shai, who's a great authority on all issues of Masorah, the Mincha Shai points out there are two traditions whether the word should be read shatu or shatu. And there's no way to tell from the trap because it's placed after the word, because originally the tlishas were just a circle and the only way to distinguish gadol and katana was put the one before and one after. Now, that's one place where it's difficult. The other place which is very annoying is the following. Even when you have a word whose accent is on the last syllable, sometimes what will happen if the next word has the accent on the first syllable and they're a mishares and the first word's a mishares, the accent will back up. It's called the nasog achor. The accent backs up because it's hard to pronounce two primary accents consecutively. So let me give you an example. By Yosef and his brothers, vayomru lo echav, it should have been vayomru lo echav. It's a mapach pashta. And because of the accent on lo is on the first syllable, it becomes vayomru, not vayomru. Now, that when is a word, when does an accent back up, when does it not back up? I would pay somebody a lot of money if you could give me all the rules to figure out exactly. I have a pretty good chush, but there are so many exceptions, it's not clear what the rules are. So here's the question. What happens when you have a Tlisha Kitana, or a Gedola for that matter, followed by, it has to be a Tlisha Kitana, followed by a word that happens to have the accent on the first syllable? This very same word, Vayomru lo, appears in Megillas Esther. Vayomru lo chachamav. So how do you know whether it's Vayomru lo chachamav or the way I read it the first time, which is correct? And the answer is there's no way to know for sure. I will tell you that in this case, some tikkunim now decide that they, as I mentioned before, pashta, the rule with pashta is one pashta, accent is milara. Two pashtas, the accent is Mila El. Some tikkunim have decided on all of the other notes to do the same thing. You won't find this in the Masoretic Codices, but some modern printings have done that. Even Reb Breuer on Vayom Rulo prints two Tlisha Katanas to tell you that it is Mila El. But that's the place where this can be very, very difficult and tricky because the Tlishas do not tell you by their placement where the accent is. Okay, moving on to Kadma V'Asla. The Asla, I wrote it this way here. It's Reb Breuer always refers to it as a Geirish. I don't know who decided to call Asla and then Asla Geirish, but the word is a Geirish. And you can probably figure out why this is a Geirish and the next one is a Gershayim, based upon the dual form. So a Geirish is a single line and a Gershayim is two of them. These two trop are essentially equivalent. It's determined primarily by syllable, number of syllables, comma words, whether you have an Asla of a Geirish or a Gershayim, those are both Shalishim. And they are normally officially supposed to be the Shlish Acharon before the Mishnah. Sometimes a Munach Legarmei will insert itself, But typically, they're supposed to be the last shlish before the Mishnah. Okay. Now moving on, Darga Sevir. We're almost at the end. A Darga is always a Mishares. A Darga, I would say, 80 to 90% of the time at least, precedes a Tevir, which we'll talk about in a second. But there is an unusual sequence, but it's not rare, of Darga Munach Revi'i. Darga Munach Revi'i. I'm not sure if this is always true, and I know you're going to all be very upset at me when I say this, but there are situations where a mafsik changes into a misharis. A mafsik trup gets converted. It has a tmura. Now, I know this is really maddening because now you're going to say, well, what point is the trup? When you could always look at certain mafsik and misharism and say, well, that's not really a misharis. That's a mafsik, but it's a converted. Now, I believe, Rebroyer, I don't know if he says it this way, but when you have darga munach revi'i, the munach was supposed to be a mafsik. And I think that if you look at the examples, if you look at, officially speaking, darga munach sevir is a three-word unit because darga and munach are both misharism. They serve the revi'i. But if you look at them, and I haven't systematically studied them, but I think you'll see that actually when you look at those three-word phrases, there really should be a small pause after the second word. So in that case, when you see that sequence, this is unusual. But the normal sequence is Dargah Sevir. One particularly interesting tidbit about this is sometimes it's Dargah Sevir, and very often it's Mercha Sevir. In other words, sometimes the Mishari Sevir is a Dargah, sometimes it's a Mercha. There is a rule to this. The rule has, and I may have seen one or two exceptions. If there are two syllables or more that separate the accent of the darga to the tvir, you get a darga. If there's one syllable separating them, or not even one syllable, you get a mercha. Yeah, just a kind of a interesting, I don't know, someone pointed this out to me years ago, and the rule seems to hold. Now, a tvir is a mishnah. And a tvir, we've seen before that the zarka is the mishnah of the segal, pashta is the mishnah of the zakef, and the tvir is the mishnah of the tipcha. Right? You will never find a pashta that leads directly into a tipcha, or a zarka that leads directly into a tipcha, or a munach, or a revi that leads directly into a tipcha. If there is a mishnah before a tipcha that precedes it, the immediately preceding mishnah must be a tvir. And that brings us to the end, which is Mercha Tibcha Mercha Sof Pasuk. If for whatever reason, a Sof Pasuk's Mishares is a Mercha, and a Snachta's Mishares is a Munach. Don't know why. It's Mercha Tibcha Munach Esnachta here, Mercha Tibcha Mercha Sof Pasuk. Now, Sof Pasuk is not really its term. That's the term that we commonly use. The actual term for it is a Siluk. Now, one confusing thing about Sof Pasuk, but usually it's not terribly confusing, is that it uses the same symbol as the Ga'aya, as the secondary accent. How do you know whether it's a Sof Pasuk or a Ga'aya? Well, start with the following. If it's not on the last word of the Pasuk, you know that it's a Ga'aya, it's a secondary accent. Every Sof Pasuk, and this I will assert with absolute certainty, every single Siluk / Sof Pasuk in Tanakh is found on the last word of the pasuk. I think that we can assume is a safe bet. Okay. Now, there's one word in Tanakh that took me a while to figure out, the word medva in Parshas Chukas. There are two things that look like a siluk there. One of them is a gaya. One of them is the sof pasuk. You have to figure out which one is which. I'm not going to talk about that now, but if you want to torture yourself, you could think about that question and see if you can figure out the answer. There are a few more trup, which I didn't put. I see. I may have I've broken things down this way, so you may find this helpful. If you have this file, you have everything listed. There are a few more. A few trup that I omitted. Number one is the gal. We spoke about the galga. I guess it's only the mercha chula that I haven't given it its due. The mercha chula is written as two merchas. The mercha chula is, there are only five in Chumash. I don't know how many there are in Nach. The mercha chula is a mishares. The way you can prove it's a mishares, aside from meaning, is from 2 weeks ago's parsha. In Parsha Shmos, it's lama sa'aseh Cho la avadecha. And saseh has the mercha chula. And since cho is missing the dagesh, you know that it has that the previous word has to be a misharis. If you ask him what the mercha kfula is, interestingly enough, mercha kfula, I heard it growing up just doing a double tavir. I didn't actually thought that makes sense. A very good friend of mine, who I think his father's in the audience here, Yossi Prager, who's a very fine Baal Kriya, so he has some, I don't know if it's a Yekish thing or some music that he was taught for the mercha kfula. So I don't do it, but I used to think that made more sense. But Reb Breuer actually thinks that it probably does sound like a tavir. He talks about the shape, suggesting, in fact, how the music was intended. So I don't know what's right or wrong, but now I feel a little better. I read a mercha kfula as two tavirs. A mercha kfula is always a mesharis to a tipcha. Okay. The few other symbols, which I'm really not going to dwell upon when we move to the next phase, which I think, as things are looking, is going to probably be next week, although maybe we'll start a little bit. Firstly, the pasek. That's that dash in between. Very often a pasek comes between two misharsim to create some kind of division. It has various usages. I'm not going to go through them now. Then you have the gaya, which is, as you can see, exactly the same symbol as the sof pasuk. Very rare. There are only a few in Chumash. You have what's called a ma'ayla. I gave you one example here. A ma'ayla is when you only have one word on an esnachta or a sof pasuk, one word or one unit. Vayetze Noach is one unit because it's joined by the makaf. And if you see what looks like a tipcha there, it's not a tipcha. You can't have a pause in the middle of the word. It's called a ma'ayla. Don't ask me how you do it. I just fake it. I would read Vayetze Noach or something like that. I don't want to read a full pause like a tipcha because it's not a tipcha. There are only a few in Chumash like this. I think Bishavu Osechem, you even have words before that in Parshas Emor also has that. The makaf here is the line between the two aleph's, and the makaf simply takes multiple words and joins them into one unit for the purposes of trop analysis and so on. And finally, you have a misiga, which when it looks like a pashta, but it's not. A misiga will appear on the same word or on the same joined word. It has to be a certain length with a zakef katon. The way I was taught, the way I learned to do it, we read as, you know, a zakef katon doesn't have so much music. A zakef gadol, and the misiga, we would read misiga katon or something like that. But basically, it's almost like it could just as well be a secondary accent. So now, to kind of wrap up a little bit this part, here we have the list of things. So I encourage you to take this file, plagiarize it, use it for whatever you want. Don't blame me for any mistakes in it, even though they are 100% my fault. Here we have the list of the trap. We have two kesarim, the esnachta and the siluk, or it's called so pasuk. We have three malachim, the segol, and its substitute shalsheles. We have the zakefs, and we have the tipcha. And the tipcha is always the melech acharon, before an esnachta or a siluk. A segol is always the first thing in the pasuk. The mishnim, the next line here, so each one is, the last three are paired up. The zarka is the mishnah for the segol, the pashta is the mishnah for the zakef, and the tvir is the mishnah for the tipcha. The revi stands alone. The revi is never going to be the last mishnah. The revi, again, will never be. You might have a revi, then a zarka and a segol, but not a revi before a segol without a zarka in between. And the same thing holds true for the others. And then finally, we have the shalishin, which are the gerish slash gershayim, which is officially supposed to be the last shalish. A pazer and pazer gadol, which are supposed to be the ones that precede the gerish gershayim. The tlisha gadola, which is a substitute for a pazer. And a munach legarmeh, which is its own thing. And then the rest of the list, I'm sorry, it goes off the screen, of the Misharsim. The first five are the really, really common ones. Tlisha Katana is a bit less common, and the rest of them are pretty rare. The Mercha Kefula, the Galgal, otherwise known as Yerach Ben Yoma, the Ma'ila, and the I don't know if I would count the Misiga as such, or the Ma'ila. Okay. I'm not sure, Rabbi Kilman, should I stop now for questions, you think, or should I start?
If you're going to move on to a totally new subject, you may want to spend a couple minutes on questions. If anybody has an important question, maybe we can do the comments later. But if anybody has a particular question, just in terms of making sure they got all this clear.
Okay, I'm going to stop the share, at least so I can see people. Go ahead. If you want to feed me the questions from the chat or something, if anybody wants to.
Right. So I think we might as well wait the chat. There's sort of all these little comments on the chat. But if anybody would like to speak up with the question or comment, please do so now. Otherwise, we can take them all at the end.
A question on Chatu.
Yes.
So how do you know that it's Chatu and not Chatu?
You don't know. The Mincha Shai says that there are two traditions. My personal preference in that case is to read it as Shatu for a simple reason. If someone read Shatu when they should have read Shatu, I wouldn't correct them because they've in effect corrected the word towards its actual meaning. Whereas if you take, the word Shatu, it doesn't exist in biblical Hebrew. And Shatu means, Shin Vav Tes, it means to fly around. Mishut ba'aretz u'mi'saleich ba. If there were such a word, Shatu, it would mean to act like a crazy person, as in Shoteh. Nice. So I would rather, given that if I'm reading it Shatu, that's actually the meaning, I'd rather err in that direction. But I would not correct anybody for reading it the other way. There are two traditions on it.
So I just a short anecdote. Somebody I know who's really a huge Talmud Chacham, he has often refused to read Baal Osva just because of that.
I might jokingly say I'm surprised he hasn't started a minhag to read it twice. Okay.
But Rav, if it's possible to put a link to the sheet that you just shared with us, it was not posted before the share tonight.
That was a mistake of ours. We'll get it posted. We posted the same sheet twice by mistake, so we'll get this one posted. I apologize for that.
Okay.
In at the end of Nassau, Perek Zayin, Pasuk Pei Zayin, this is by the Maftir, the summary of the Nesiim. Mm-hmm. You have a sequence of Kadavi Azla Dargo Munach Revi, Mapach Pashta, Dargo Sevir, Mercha Tipha Snachta. You have a Pashta there and there is no Zakef at all.
Call back on.
You can have a Pashta without a Zakef, it's not unheard of.
So you're right, there is none there. So they're always going to be an exception to the rule.
Right.
Rabbi.
He can turn into a pashta sometimes.
Yes, Rebroyer talks about that, but I'm not sure why in that case. That I'm not sure that case makes sense in those terms. So I'm glad I prefaced it by saying that almost every one of these rules has exceptions, but they're very rare.
Haki Lukstein taught me to read Mercha Kefula. Mercha Kefula back in Masad in 1953. Robert probably knows when it was, but around that time.
That's how I learned it too.
Okay. Established way of singing it.
My grandfather told me much the same thing for in Haftarah in Lani Basimchi.
Right. Cool. So again, I don't claim to have a real tradition on this, so I won't argue in anybody else's reading.
How did he teach you to do it in Rani Vesemchi? Because I've been wondering about that for years.
It was, and it's because it changes into major, even though the rest of the trap is minor. But it was Hala
Ud Mutzalmei Eish. Okay.
Mm-hmm. But you're not singing half Torah trap now. You're singing Torah trap.
All right.
How are you saying
that's the thing. It changes that one trup is in major.
Okay.
That's the
one. Okay, fine.
Are there any other questions?
Yeah, question. A Koran edition sometimes has a katon symbol, not preceded by a munach or a pashta.
Right.
Why would that be?
So that is the equivalent like a misiga katon. Some manuscripts don't put in the misiga at all. Reb Breuer has probably a lot more cases without the Masiga that he prints, but there's really fundamentally no difference between as a cave katon alone and a misiga katon. It's the same thing.
There are cases where you have a katon, like Lehav Deal in Bracy, where one of them is a zakeif gadol and one of them is a zakeif katon because the zakeif because it's the wrong shape, and it happens.
So you know, what were you saying? I know. There are different. There might be some chumashim have different trap there. One may have a siga katon and one has a gadol.
No, there's lahavdil and ulahavdil, and one of them is a zakeif gadol.
Yes, the other one lahavdil without the vav. I think that has to do with syllable word length.
Exactly,
because it has a yayah in it, so it's gadol, and so it is a zakeif katon, and without a mikiga, without anything, it's just that happens.
Right, but the point is, common, but a misiga katon or without the misiga is essentially like a zakeif gadol. It's different only because of the word length, but it's a standalone melech, in effect.
Okay, I'm going to recommend we go ahead and we take the rest of the questions afterwards. Okay.
So
we can get at least.
I'm going to get started. So I'm going to now share the sort of present what I'm going to call the algorithm. So I'm going to share the sheet, but we'll sort of. Okay, this is the one I assume that was up there in duplicate. What I've done on this sheet, and feel free between now and next week to sort of work through it and see what I've done, is I start with the whole pasuk. At the end here, I actually mark things where the more bars is the bigger the pause. And you can see how the sequence, how the pasuk breaks down. Now, here's the way basically it works. Firstly, as I said last week, trup divides the pasuk. It doesn't always conform to the meaning for various considerations. I say much more often than not, it will, but not always. Now, the way trup works is it tends to divide into two. Now, the first step of division in a pasuk is very straightforward. It actually doesn't follow the rules, is the esnachta. The esnachta, where there is one, divides the pasuk into two equal parts. There are two equal parts. We might tend to think musically of a sof pasuk as a bigger pause, but fundamentally there are two equal parts of the pasuk. The way, when you have a part that you want to break down, so the way to think about it is the last trup in a part, in any segment, rules over that which precedes it. So we talk about a trup being preceded by a mishares, that's literally the most servile of the trup. But a misharis always precedes the word that it serves, not comes after the word that it would serve. So if you have an esnachta or you have a sof pasuk, everything before that in its half is mishubad, is basically a servant to it. Now, so what serves a kesar? So if you want to break up either of those segments, the major break gets a melech, one level down. So if you take a look at the first pasuk here as an example, Vayetze me imparo, Vayeter al Hashem, the first half of the pasuk, Vayetze me imparo, it's pretty short. The way that if you were to break it into two units, it's going to be Vayetze and me imparo, and Vayetze gets a melech, which is the tipcha. And the same thing for the second half, which is even shorter, Vayeter al Hashem, there's only one way to break it down. The way you break it down is with a melech. Now, if you have a segment, so in this pasuk is so short. If you take, for example, the one two-word part, me'im paro, which is two pieces. So the way, this case, me'im is a mishares. But if you, for some reason, didn't want to put a mishares, let's say hypothetically, I'm reluctant to use this as the pasuk. Let's say you had something before the vayetze. You had a long thing before the tipcha, and you wanted to break that down. The way you break down that unit is with one level below a melech, which is a mishnah. Now, here's the interesting question. Supposing you have a mishnah, a melech here, and then later on, right here, you have a kesar. Supposing you want to break this part down further, what do you use? The answer is, what dictates the breakdown is the end of the unit. So if there were more words in between a Vayetze and Paro, you'd have to break that down again with a melech. But you have to think about what that means. What it means is, if you see, let's just take the simplest example. You have a half pasuk that ends with an esnacha, and you see a bunch of melachim. The biggest pause is the first one. That's the one that breaks it down into two. The next melech breaks the part between the first melech and the esnachta further down into two. In other words, if you're at a certain level and you want to break down to, I know I'm doing this backwards. If you want to break down to your right earlier in the pasuk, you have to descend the level. If you want to break down to your left between you and the thing that you serve, you stay on the same level. Because the way you break any unit down is by looking at the piece that ends that unit. So in Esnachta, if you have six malachim in front of it, I don't think you ever get six. You get five occasionally. Maybe there's a couple places with six. The first of the six malachim is going to be the biggest breakdown. And then the next melech is going to break down the second part of that. And the next melech break down the next what's remaining, and so on and so forth. And that logic, that algorithm is the better way of describing it, is going to hold true with every sequence. If I have a Mishnah, and now I'm breaking things down, I have a melech, and I want to break things down from A to, from some point up until a melech, the way that's going to break down is with a Mishnah. If I have multiple Mishnahs, the first Mishnah, the earlier Mishnah, is the first biggest break. If I want to break things down to the right earlier than that Mishnah, I use a Shalish. If I want to break things down to the left of it, then I use another Mishnah and so on. So whenever, as we break the Psukim down, and we'll start with this next week, what we're going to do is each time, we're first going to look for the middle break of the Pasuk, that's the Snacha. Within each half, we're going to look to see how to break it down. And then we're going to try to break down each of those quarters, if we can call it down, into eighths and so on. So at some point, you reach a stage, there's nothing more to break. In other words, the units have gotten too short, and you're either down to one word or you're down to a Mashares and a Mafsik. But that is the basic method that's used with the Tiberian system of Trop. That's how it's understood. As I said, it doesn't always conform perfectly to meaning, but more often than not, it actually makes sense. All right, so I think we'll stop here. If there are any questions just on the comments that I made, I know I just kind of opened things up, and then I think it will be easier to see as I demonstrate next week with the number of psukim that I've sampled below, and hopefully we can, hopefully will make a little bit more sense to you that way. Any questions?
As far as two trop on the same word, like zeh, you know, chameinu maaseinu. I'm not going to get into zoreya zera because you'll tell me that's a mistake. But I think on zeh, I think everyone agrees there are two trop on the zeh. Any thoughts on that?
So I'm trying to, Rebroyer explains why they're there. And I'm trying to remember what it is. He explains why. He explains why you actually have to read Klisha Gedola before the Gershaim. Like in my tikkun, it said that. My old, like, tikkun makarim, I think it said that. But he explains why. I can't remember now. I believe that during the week, I'll go back and I'll find where he talks about it. He explains the origin. There are two in the Torah. There's Zeyin Achameinu, and then there's, in I think, Parsha Shemini, Si'u Kirvu. Kirvu. Those are the two. He explains why. I apologize. I don't remember why now, but I will try to lean out to get the answer for next week.
And how did the mistake develop on Zoreya Zera, Zera, on the two syllables, two different trop? Any thoughts on that, or are you familiar with the error?
No, the only thing I know is that Desha in many Chumashim has a Zakate, but Rebroya prints a Revi. But I'm not familiar with it with that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay. I think that's it. I think you covered most of the things in the chat box, some of which, let's see, I'm just quickly going to run through the chat box also. Rechatula, tivcha, exceptions. Sometimes, I think if Revi is two mishartim, the first has to be a darga, unless it's a merchatula. I don't remember if you spoke about that. Okay, Baruch wants to know how many people are Balei Kriya in this audience. I don't see everybody, but I see a whole bunch of hands go up. Okay, all right, very good. All right.
I will comment one thing. I was sort of quasi-apologize. I discovered this from preparing the material on the Sifrei Emes. I don't think I'd be able to understand Reb Breuer if I didn't know how to lane Sifrei Emes. And just knowing how to lane it in the first place makes it much, much easier to understand the system. It's not that you can't do it. It's harder if you're not, you don't have to be a Baal Kore, but if you're familiar enough with the trap, then it's much easier to sort of understand how some of this works. Again, you don't need to be, you don't need to, you can do it mechanically, but it comes more intuitively. And that's, people know that a segel is a big pause. It's kind of obvious. And any Baal Kriya knows that there's always a Zarka before a segel. I know there's one exception. We don't read that pasuk in shul. So there's sort of the familiar rhythms of Kriya Satorah, which helps. So a lot of what I've said tonight fits more easily into knowledge that Baal Kriya have, but haven't articulated. Kind of latent knowledge.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. Any last questions? Otherwise, Rabbi Weider, thank you very much. We'll please God, we'll see you next week.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Rabbi Weider, do you have a Misora to actually lane Tamei Emes?
I do. It's not my, I could talk about it when we get to the Tamei Emes. If you're really, really interested, it's not terribly expensive, but there's an app that I put out recently on, it's both on both App Store and the Play Store, with the entire Sefer Tehillim laned, with text and translation. But there is somebody who recorded some tradition. He tells you how he got to it. It wasn't his. And so you can, if you can find his files, they're somewhere on the web, but I don't know where. You can just listen. He has a few samples there. So I don't have, it's not, I learned this several years ago. It had been sitting in my files for 20 years. Someone had sent it to me, but about 5 years ago when I was in Camp Stone, I finally took the time to sit down and learn a new thing at Trump. It's very, very actually useful. But God willing, we'll get to it in a couple of weeks.